Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron Erber, and today there's a new book out by a classical educator. His name is Dr. Junius Johnson, and he is here today to talk about that book, to talk about what a classical education is, and how fairy stories factor in to a classical education. So Dr. Junius, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And if you could just give some background, who you are, whatever, you know, what you teach, where you teach, just any background information you want, you can go into as much detail as you want.
Yeah, so I'm a theologian and philosopher, independent scholar. I did my doctoral studies at Yale. I focus on what I like to call philosophical theology. And so that's considering the doctrines of the Christian faith using the rigorous tools of philosophy, asking hard questions about that sort of thing. I have a lot of specialty. I spent a lot of time in the Middle Ages. For me, I'm very interested in the way the church has thought through the central mysteries of the faith through the centuries. And the Middle Ages, especially the High Middle Ages and Scholasticism, represents a high watermark from the standpoint of philosophical reflection on those types of things. And so if I want to ask questions about the Eucharist or about Christology or whatnot, I find the richest array of tools are there in the medieval church. And then the church starts to get bogged down with other concerns culturally and other outside challenges, and that theological reflection doesn't progress in the same way. So I start to lose interest a bit when we come out of the medieval period into the Reformation and whatnot. So that's kind of how I, with my background as an academic, we'll talk more in a second, I think, about an earlier background that's relevant to this material here. But using all of that, I went off and I started teaching. I taught at Yale, I taught at Baylor University for a number of years. And then right at the beginning of the pandemic, I stepped away from all of that for personal reasons and spent a lot of time just reflecting, spending more time with my family, working on myself. And out of that, I found myself moving into a different season of offering courses online. So I started a business called Junius Johnson Academics, and I offer courses for adults and for children in theology, literature, and philosophy. And so some of the things I teach will be things like, right now I'm teaching a Theology of the Imagination course for adults, which is one of my favorite classes that I offer, thinking through what is the role of theology, of the imagination, and in relationship to God, how does it work in a Christian life, these sorts of things. I teach classes on Narnia, on Lewis and Space Trilogy, on medieval culture, theology of beauty, various sorts of things like this. This coming summer, I'll be teaching courses, but again, for both adults and children on fairies. And so we'll be reading fairy stories together, specifically the explicitly fairyland related stories, which is always a good time. So that's kind of what I do at this point. You can find that stuff on academics.juniusjohnson.com. And then I spend a lot of time, my scholarly time, doing essay writing, writing. This book represents more of the type of work I want to do now, which is to begin to really focus in on how do we resource the riches of Christian thought for meaningful lives of discipleship in the contemporary world that's deeply engaged with the contemporary world, that's not postured against the world as something that we've got to either hide from or attack, but it's saying, no, there are problems, there are deep ills in our society that we as Christians participate in. Let's go back to our font, let's go back to that source that we have in our faith and find the resources that have always been there that we need to bring to bear on this cultural moment in order to make progress forward, to do what we can to hasten the coming of the kingdom of God.
Very nice. And then, so yeah, those classes all sound good. Right now I'm reading a book by, I think her name is Christiana Hale, about the Space Trilogy, C.S. Lewis' Space Trilogy. I think it's called like Compass for Deeper Heaven or something like that. Have you read that?
I have, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm reading that right now.
very helpful guide. I would definitely recommend that to people. For if you don't know everything that C.S. Lewis knew, which is probably all of us, it's a helpful way to begin getting your mind around some of what's happening. There's references all over that thing, and it's really hard to pick up on if you don't have some sort of guidance.
Yeah, it's been very helpful. And then I've been going through and just kind of like highlighting different things in the books. But yeah, I want to try to have her on the show. I got to reach out to her at some point. We'll figure out how to do that. So yeah, that sounds great. So yeah, you teach a lot of classes online for adults and children. And so this book, this is On Teaching Fairy Stories, A Guide to Cultivating Wonder in Students Through Great Literature. So what brought you to write this book? What is this book about? And how does it kind of fit into classical education?
Yeah, so when I was in, I think I was in kindergarten. It was either kindergarten or pre-K, we used to call it Head Start. And we'd have nap time, and right before nap time, the teacher would read to us. And mm-hmm. one of the books she read to us was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And well, I mean, that just blew me away. It became my favorite book immediately. As soon as I found out there were more, I got them and I started reading the rest of them. And I've been reading them ever since. I don't know how many times I've read them, but it's a very, very high number. So later on, in my teenage years, coming towards the end of high school, when I became a Christian, I discovered the rest of C.S. Lewis, not just the other fiction, but also the whole apologist side of him, which I had not known about before. And I was really fascinated by the idea that the guy who had written these children's books that I loved so much was also such an articulate defender of this faith that I had recently come to accept as my own. Through him, I encountered MacDonald and sort of became aware of this lineage of people talking about fantasy literature in relation to ultimate truth. And so like back to G.K. Chesterton, MacDonald, Lewis, Tolkien, obviously. And this was always, whenever I come across one of these essays by these guys, I get so excited because I've loved fantasy literature ever since I read The Chronicles of Narnia. And all the years between when Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was read to me and when I became a Christian are filled with fantasy stories of one sort or another. As I long for wizards and dragons and all these other sorts of things. It's obvious that a sword is better than a gun, and that's what I think. So it was really great to have these guides to help me think about why might that be the case. And this is not just something that belongs to a childish desire for adventure and excitement and strange things and magic and whatnot, but there actually might be something meaningfully spiritual reflected in this desire that I had. And yet, as I read through those essays and kind of got through, you know, that's, I mean, Tolkien's On Fairy Stories is the high watermark for reflection on this stuff. And I got to the end of it and I just felt like, but there's so much he hasn't done, right? And when I read George MacDonald, The Fantastic Imagination, I'm like, what is it, right? And it's one essay, The Imagination, It's Culture and something like that. And in it, he talks about rules for the imagination. And he talks about what happens when you violate the rules of the imagination, but he never tells you what the rules of the imagination are. So for a long time, I wanted to join this venerable line of Christian thinkers reflecting on the role of fantasy stories and reflecting on the imagination. And so the imagination course is part of a project that's ultimately going to issue in a book that is going to be a theology of the imagination. And then this On Teaching Fairy Stories has been something that's been close to my heart for a long time. Actually, the very first things I ever wrote, very first essays I ever wrote when I was in high school, a new Christian, they weren't assigned for anything. I was just trying to be like C.S. Lewis and write. I thought what Christians did was that we write about stuff that we cared about. So I started doing that, and the very first essays I wrote had to do with fairyland. I revisited them when this book came out, and there's actually a YouTube video of me reading one of those early essays from childhood me, from high school me, on fairies. So this has been growing in my soul for a long time, and eventually I came to this point where I thought, I've been teaching more about fairy stories. I've been teaching through this, thinking a lot more particularly about fairyland. I think I'm at a point where I can say something definitive. Not necessarily my last word on fairies, but at least something that would gather up the thoughts I've had to this point and will be a meaningful contribution to that conversation that my heroes have been participating in. So that's what this book is. And I decided to come at it from the standpoint not just of fairy stories in general and their value in human life, but specifically why they really are helpful and essential in education, and particularly in the type of education that I'm concerned with, which is classical education, an older pre-modern model of educating. Because I think that fairy stories offer us a corrective that is much needed to what's happening and how we're forming young souls today. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me that I could make the argument in terms of how we're teaching, how we're educating and raising children, and then not limited to that, but go beyond that and also make larger points about their role in the lives of all of us as humans, because there should be a continuity between mm-hmm. how we're raising up children and how we live. The point is we're raising them up to live as we live. And so those two things ought to be in conversation, and there always ought to be that kind of directedness of, hopefully I'm trying to do the things that I want them to be able to do as well, you know?
Right. Right. Well, education is about passing on culture, right? That's, and okay. It's like giving them what you have and helping, yeah, like you said, helping them live how you live. And that would be for like liturgical Christians who have a strong liturgical tradition. That'd be something like that, right? Where you kind of initiate them into the divine liturgy. Certainly.
That's really what education is. Yep. How we've received from the past and then how we hand that on to the succeeding generations.
Right. Yep. Exactly. No, that's great. So how important is wonder for a person, and what is wonder? Because you talk about wonder in your book, and that is an important part of like any kind of education, including classical. But so what is wonder, and how important is it?
Yeah. Wonder is what happens when we encounter something that exceeds our expectations. And that can be, that's a very general definition. And mm-hmm. so wonder can happen in more and less mundane ways. Right. I mean, we've domesticated the word. We'll say, huh, I wonder why that's the case, when it's not this big life changing thing. It's just a kind of, you know, I don't intend to do any work to figure out how it's the case. I just, it would be interesting to know that. Moving on.
Right. There's no sacrifice there or anything. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Even a day when the only sacrifice is to take your phone out of your pocket, still sometimes you're like, oh, that's weird. And you just keep moving.
Right.
But the experience of the experience that Isaiah had, when he suddenly saw the Lord high and lifted up, mm-hmm. it fell down on his face, that type of wonder that overwhelmed him to the point that he thought, that's it, game over, I'm dead.
Exactly.
This is the end of Isaiah right here. There's a straight line from that, I wonder why that's the case, to Isaiah thinking he's about to be unmade because he's seeing the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difference of degree that turns into a qualitative difference, but it's the same fundamental thing, which is we're being impressed by the way that the thing before us goes beyond what we expected it to do, mm-hmm. what we expect it to be. That could happen in our knowledge or whatnot. So then, if that's true, I think wonder is only one of the most important things that needs to be in a person's life. Because what wonder does is wonder keeps our souls from shrinking too small.
Hmm.
Right. Every day I get up and I get the kids out of bed and I get the kids dressed, and it takes a long time, and I get the kids breakfast and we sit there for a long time figuring out what they want for dinner. I do all this work to get the kids out the door, and when they finally get out the door, it's like, oh, not going to work. And so then I put all this work into, you know, going to work, doing these things. I've got to do laundry, I've got to do dishes, I'm doing my own research, I've got classes to teach, I've got students to meet with, I've got to clean the bathroom. And it's just a continuing litany of things that have to be done. And if you're not careful, if I'm not careful, that's all I'll think about, is what's the next thing I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm created in the image of an unimaginably majestic God to be a place where his creative energy pours into the world and shapes it up into new forms that it never had before. In order to really do that well, or at all, I've got to look at something more than just what's the next load of laundry to go into the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that daily life is continually pulling our gaze down and telling us to focus small and just get this task done and the next task and the next task. Wonder yanks our gaze back up. It spreads out our hearts. It opens our awareness, And without, you know, we need big hearts if we're going to love our neighbor.
Yeah.
Stress and come alongside them and make space for them with misericordia, right? Of our own wretchedness of heart that responds to theirs. We need really, really broad minds if we're going to be captivated by the vision of beauty, by the vision of God's beauty, right? You can't have mystical visions if you can't see beyond the end of your nose.
Mm-hmm.
And wonder, I think, is this powerful dynamic in creation that is there to keep us from getting too focused on the small things. And I mean small in the sense of meaning, because the tiniest things in size are wonders as well.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Wonderful book, if you haven't read this, readers, listeners, Chesterton's Tremendous Trifles is a delightful series of essays that is all him saying, let me look at small things, like what have I got in my pocket?
Yeah, right.
And dig into how amazing those things are if we only would dignify them with our attention.
Mm-hmm.
So wonder slows us down so that we pay more attention to things around us. Wonder lifts our eyes up, and wonder makes us look beyond the barriers of ourselves and see the others out there that we can be coming alongside of and that we can have come alongside us. It helps us to live together as a body.
Yeah. Well, it helps us to remember that it's not all about us and all about our small, you know, the daily things we have to do. Like, wonder helps us to recognize that there's just more than just us. You know, it's more than just me.
Yeah.
And it pulls us out of ourselves, 'cause we're, like, if you imagine, like, meeting a talking lion, you know, that would be pretty traumatized by that. But you probably wouldn't be thinking, you know, well, maybe you would be thinking a little bit about yourself, like, please don't eat me, you know. But you would be, you know, your world would be exploded, you know, and you.
It shows your awareness. What are you going to see of that? That's why he's so big. My favorite moment in the Chronicles is when Jill first meets Aslan.
Mm.
She doesn't know who he is. And he's sitting by the stream and she wants a drink of water. And he's like, she's like, I want a drink of water. And he's like, can you come and get a drink? And she's like, would you mind moving over there? And he's like, yes, I would. And she's like, do you even eat girls? And he's like, yeah, I've eaten girls and boys and kings and queens and kingdoms and all this kind of stuff. And so she's like, he's like, aren't you thirsty? And she says, yeah, I feel like I'm going to die of thirst. And she says, then come and drink. And she says, I don't dare. And he says, then you're going to die of thirst.
Yeah.
The lion doesn't move for you.
Right.
It's going to be there and you've got to come to terms with it.
Right.
And if we don't believe that there are things like that in the world that we live in, then we're not going to navigate the world very successfully.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what these stories can do, is to remind us that there are immovable lions.
You know, that's right.
There are things out there that are not us, and that we have to bend to those rules, and because we have this tendency to, I was just talking about this to somebody on Twitter, about how in the West we tend to take things and make them in our, well, everybody does this to an extent, but we take things like and we twist them into our own image to kind of fit into what we think is appropriate. So he was talking about, like, the I don't know much about this, but like the I Ching, like the this was Jonathan Geltner. He's been on the show before, but like he was talking about that and how Philip K. Dick, the science fiction author, would use the I Ching to like predict the future, which is not what you should do. It's not a good thing. Don't do that. But Jonathan Geltner was saying, oh, no, that's not actually what the I Ching is for. It's like this deep philosophical, like metaphysical, like wisdom literature, and that you could use it for predicting the future, you know, but that's not what it's for. And like we in the West, we have this tendency to take something and we just like twist it and make it like useful and pragmatic for us, you know, even to the point where we take like wisdom literature and make it into a fortune telling device, which is problematic for many reasons, not to mention like danger to your soul. But we have this tendency to like make everything like fit into our own boxes that we've constructed for ourselves. And you kind of talk about that a bit going into this, like in your section, like the ills of modernity, you know, and then how these fairy stories can kind of remedy those ills. And one of them is pragmatism. Like we just, this, like everything has to be useful. Everything has to have a place that is immediately useful to us. And if it doesn't, we have to make it or get rid of it, you know? And so we can kind of get to that a little bit, but like, What is, so you start off with like, what is a fairy story? And then like the nature of fairy. What is fairy? And you have a quote here. A fae thus unites the magical, mystical, and strange with both a mentally affected state and tends towards lunacy. We might say touched, an immortal peril. And then fairy stories have a certain quality derived from the contact with a realm where magic permeates all things more overtly than it does in our own world. So what is the nature of fairy? What is fairyland?
Yeah, as what you're reading from the recording from, I was still reflecting on the etymology of the word fae and where it comes from.
Yep.
And you know, the term fairy is actually an abstract noun referring to the state of fae, like fae things or fae-ness, in the same way that you might say, in the old days, we used to say Jewry to refer to all Jews. Mm-hmm. Fairy, that same ending re, meaning for, it's this whole nature of things. So fairy is this noun that describes this quality. So what is the quality? And it is a quality. It's funny, you know, Tolkien's on fairy stories. He goes on and on for a bit before finally arriving at what you might consider to be a definition of fairy stories, which he doesn't present as a definition. He just sort of says fairy stories are concerned with other worlds. Mm-hmm. That's really what fairy stories are. They're concerned with other worlds. Why should it matter that they're other, right? I mean, mm-hmm. every other world is not an other world to the people who live in it. Our world is an other world to people who live in, you know, Narnia or Middle Earth or whatever else. And so what is it about the otherness that is so important in this notion of the fae? Well, where fae begins is it begins in that numinous part of the soul, the apprehensive part of the soul, the things that you're afraid of when you're a kid, the monster under your bed. You can't describe it. It's not specifically, you know, an elephant or a lion or something like that. It's something much more indefinable than that. Mm-hmm. And yet it's no less palpably felt. There are these deep parts within us that I think are a combination of the fact that we remember the dread majesty of the God who made us, and of the fact that we're aware of, we remember the serpent and we remember the dark forces we ourselves have unleashed into the world. And out of that primordial soup of our souls comes nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
But in that same place, the cure for nightmares comes from that same place, because nothing drives a nightmare out so thoroughly as a beautiful dream. And one of the reasons we can't forget the dread majesty of God, yes, the first reason we can't forget the dread majesty of God is because we know we've got to go before him someday. We do believe in judgment deep down in our souls. But the other reason is because we know that it's good. He's good. Right? He may mm-hmm. not be safe, but he's good. And we want goodness so badly, even while at the same time we don't want it, because we know that we can't stand before it and have all the things you just talked about. We can't have it our way,
right,
and stand before goodness. Right. So the fae comes out of that numinous place, and it just describes this air of otherness, which can go all the way from the delightful weirdness of tiny fairies who change the seasons and paint the wings of butterflies and whatnot, to a sort of spiritual intensity that would drive a sane mind insane,
mm-hmm.
drive us from the seat of reason. And so in some sense, the fae is the other custom. It's the other world, but it's the other world as a world that is a reflection of our world. It's so other, not because it's, you got no point of contact with our world, but because what it is a funhouse mirror blowing up different parts of our world out of proportion, shrinking other parts down out of proportion, so that we can begin to think differently about the relative values of things in our world.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. And then you relate, fae, it kind of refers to fate, and doom. Like if someone is fae, there's like an element of doom hanging over them.
That's right.
And in, so there's an author I reference a lot. This is the obligatory Tim Powers reference. It's one of my favorite authors. In one of his books, kind of going back to like the lunacy element of it, a mentally affected state tending toward lunacy, there's in one of his books, Alternate Roots, there's this other realm, you know, that the characters go to. In order to get there, you need to have some sort of like mental impairment. Like you need to have like a head injury or you need to get drunk before before you can enter into that world. Like, you need to be in this altered state of consciousness, like, in order to access that dangerous world. And then another element, so you touch on, you have a whole chapter in here on Christina Rossetti's poem, A Goblin Market, where the, it's about two sisters, and they're, the goblins are coming, you know, at twilight to sell their fruits, right? To sell all these enchanted fruits. And Laura, one of the sisters, eats the fruit, and then she then becomes fae, right? She's doomed. Yeah. She can't do her housework. She can't focus on anything other than getting more of that fruit. So she's like addicted to it. You know, she's this doom hanging over her. And then a more modern example would be Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norrell. Have you read that one? Yeah. The lady, oh, what's her name? Who she dances with the gentleman with the thistledown hair, and Mr. Norrell kind of gambles her life away, right? And she becomes, she's fae, right? She, and in that state, she is fae. She's doomed to dance with the gentleman forever, you know, basically. And so it's, I think it's helpful to kind of have those examples of like, this is what fae is, you know? It's like this doomed, you're like, you're in this, you are already kind of embodying the other world, you know?
Yeah.
You're already kind of living there, but you're not at the same time. You're not really a part of any world. And that it's this ultimate alienation from like our primary world and then the fairy world, you know? So it's, and you touch on that too later on of how like what does fairy do? What does it do? And it's the detethering from home, you know, like if you eat the fruit, you can't go home, but it doesn't mean that fairyland is now your home. It's like, you don't have a home. You're homeless, you know?
Right.
Yeah. That was a very interesting passage. I never thought of it like that. Like, oh, you could just live in fairyland. Like, no. You can't live anywhere. You can't live.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a powerful thought for us, because our life among in this world, as Christians, we recognize our life to be an exile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best spin we can put on it is to say it's a pilgrimage.
Right.
We have a direction. We're headed back home. But I've always been struck by the distinction in Latin and the tradition between this life is in via, on the road, and heaven is in patria, in the fatherland.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole point is, if you're a pilgrim, if you're an exile journeying back home, the one thing you can't do is settle down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got to keep moving, or you will never see the shores of home again. It's like Odysseus. He's got to keep moving if he wants to see the hills of Ithaca again. And Fairyland wants to teach this lesson, dramatize it very strongly, to say, listen, you can't stay here. The first rule of Fairyland is you can't stay.
Right.
But you came here for a reason. You can get something here that will help you on your journey. But like everything in the world, like everything that's not God, if you absolutize it, it becomes an idol, and it will become the instrument of your destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, come through Fairyland, go through its tests and trials, come out the other side, come back to our world changed. I kind of finished the book with this haunting passage from George MacDonald's Fantasties, where the hero has gone through this incredibly trying ordeal in Fairyland of his own making, as he fails morally over and over again, he transgresses over and over again, and he winds up having to die in order to make the transition back to our world. And he's thinking about it, and he was like, you know, will I have to learn the lessons of Fairyland over again in our world, or will I be able to hang on to them and put them into place? And he says, I don't know, but sometimes I think about it and I tremble. Right. And that's the power of the otherness of the fae, is to help us see more clearly the type of story we're actually involved in and make progress to that story. A fae human, there's like the women, like the people you described, the examples you give. We could add to that Lady Macbeth, add to that in a number of other folks, in Children of Húrin and Tolkien, Leonor. All of these women, and they happen to be women, what they have in common, what makes them fae, is that they're trapped on the wrong side of the mirror.
Yeah.
Caught in the other. They don't see our world clearly anymore. And that's what makes them doomed, right? Because they won't be able to navigate our world successfully. And so death is stalking them, because that's what happens when you can't navigate the world correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're detethered, you know, like you talk about modernity and modernism. One of the ills of modernity is modernism. And modernism and its like ultimate alienation from everything, you know, it's just you are yourself and that's it, you know? And postmodernism, you describe that as you say, postmodernism is not so much an attempt to escape the modernist despair of loneliness as to take command of it, celebrate it, and turn it into a strength. And then one of my favorite quotes you have in here, everybody talks about diversity, you know, and inclusion, all of that stuff. I used to work at a university too, and we were talking about diversity and all that stuff. I'm like, okay, well, in order for a diverse group of people to like be united and be truly inclusive, you have to have a shared goal. There has to be some shared common goal. So like I have my master's degree in entomology. So I was in the entomology department. I'm like, okay, our shared goal is the study of insects, right? That's our shared goal. And people actually pushed back on me. They're like, no, we don't need a shared goal. I'm like, what are you talking about? You need a shared goal. You're like, all these people from different parts of the world, different parts of, like, we're all here because we want to study insects. That's like the bare minimum of like an entomology department. It's like, you have to study insects on some level. Otherwise, you're not an entomology department. You know, it's like, and so what you say in here is like, the celebration of diversity is an attempt to reach once again for community, to find a way out of the loneliness, but a way that does not disturb our sovereign solitude. And so, like, that was, it's so on point, because it's like, yeah, we're all still our solitary selves and our little silos, you know, on our own. But we don't want that. We can't have that indefinitely because it's destructive. But we also don't want true community, because that's also very, you know, it can be very, it can make you vulnerable. It requires humility, you know, and if you work at a university, humility is not a trait you find very much.
That's right.
But that's not limited to that, to just universities. But it's I liked working there. I didn't, you know. But I'm like, this is like, you guys, this is not how you have a group of diverse people unite. It has to be some common purpose where you can put aside our differences and unite to serve this common purpose. And they're like, nah, it's not. That's not how it works. I'm like, okay, whatever.
That's the whole thing with unity, right? This is what the West is supposed to have learned from the Church, is that unity is with reference to something.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, Christ is both God and man. So God and man are united in Christ. Where does that union happen? Let's talk about that for 5 centuries, because it's really important that we get that right.
Right, right.
If that union happens in the nature, then you've destroyed both natures and you've ruined the whole project, right? And ultimately, we have to come up with a new category of union that we never had before. First, we have to invent the idea of persons. And then we've got to say the person is where the union happens, and that creates a personal or hypostatic union,
right?
Which is different than every other type of union we have.
Right.
How are these three guys one God? Again, we've got to find a type of union
right.
to describe this. And so you never have union except for with reference to something in which the union occurs.
Well,
thing, right?
So like, I don't know if you know who Jonathan Pageau is. I think he said something like, so he's an icon carver and he talks about symbolism a lot. He's Greek Orthodox. I think he's Greek Orthodox. He's Orthodox for sure. He said something like, diversity without unity is death. Because that's what happens when you die. Like, you know, you're unified in your body, but then you die and your body breaks apart and becomes diverse. You know, it becomes like, diversity without unity is death. And it's like, yeah, like, you can have diversity. Diversity is great. You know, like, we in the church, we have like 22 different sui generis churches, you know, different liturgies, different ethnicities and from different parts of the world, and all very, very diverse, different languages, different practices. But they're all in the church, we're all united under the Pope, right? Under the Pope and the councils and stuff like that. So it's like, you have that unity, but you still have this incredible rich diversity.
That's right.
But if you don't have unity, you're going to have infighting, you're going to have schisms, you're going to have heresies, you're going to have all sorts of horrible things that, you know, that'll come from not having that unity.
That's right.
So it's you need both, because if you have unity without diversity, you have, you know, dictatorship, basically. Like, you have this like flattening of everything, and everything has to be the same. And so, like, you got to have both. So going back to fairy stories, how do fairy stories, how do they kind of treat these illnesses of modernity?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, we're in this weird place where we're after modernity, but like the modern hangover hasn't gone away yet. We're still all, you know, reeling from the effects of modernity, and there's a tendency to fall back into that when we don't know, we don't have a clear sense of where we're going next. Postmodernity is like, we got to get out of this.
Right.
But there was no clear vision of where to go next, and so we keep falling back into it. I know some folks will call postmodernity just really hypermodernity. It's ultra-modern.
Right.
And so, you know, we have to identify what the problems are with modernity, and it can be summed up in modernity's world is too small.
Mm-hmm.
The modern project is the project of the Enlightenment project of elevating reason to the highest place in human life. It's really sola ratio, right? It's reason alone. And they had this whole meta-narrative where they said the Middle Ages were an age of superstition and darkness, and so we're light with reason and consciousness. And that's, of course, complete and utter nonsense. As we became suspicious of the Enlightenment's self-justifying narrative, we began to think of the Middle Ages not as an era of superstition, but an era of faith,
mm-hmm.
which means almost nothing different to a lot of people in the world, but at least
right.
to some of them, it's a positive spin. And so the Middle Ages are about faith and the Enlightenment is about reason. That's also a load of hooey, right? We're about reason nestled in faith.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it almost like the St. Patrick's festival, right? You know, faith before me, faith behind me, faith alongside me, faith within me. Reason was not alone, but it was always embraced in faith as that which needed to give it shape, direction, purpose, and meaning.
Right.
The Enlightenment project is to strip away reason and ultimately strip away imagination,
mm-hmm.
strip away faith and strip away imagination, and just leave reason alone. That is a reduced reason, an objective scientific reason, the type of reason that could be the subject of scientific study.
Yeah.
And make that the principle alone. That shrinks the nature of the world down to only the types of things, not only the types of things we can think, which is a small subset of what could be in the world, but also the types of things that we could think scientifically.
Right.
That we could think in a quasi-objective mode. And that's a really, really small world. We're limited to just the appearance of things.
Mm-hmm.
Scripture, we lose all the deeper spiritual senses of Scripture. It becomes just the literal meaning of the text.
Right, yep.
Historical critical readings of Scripture, which argue that the scriptural texts have to mean only what they could have meant to their original audience.
Right.
That's a hyper-literal reading of the sense of the text, right? We see it in, that's what physicalism is, that's what pragmatism is, that's what naturalism is, that's what skepticism is. They're all stripping away all the parts of the world that don't submit to a very narrow understanding of reason. So then, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then the remedy has to address that problem. The remedy has to do what we were saying at the outset, wonder does, explode the world back up. Because the world really is this massive, giant, magical place. And it hasn't ceased to be that just because we've stopped approaching it that way. So fairy stories are really great for that, because fairy stories are all about ways. They're all about wonder.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they're all about breaking your expectations, blowing through the walls of what you thought possible, and presenting you with weird stuff. Think about Disney's Alice in Wonderland, which is a great example of this.
Yeah.
The original animated movie, not the remake. Alice is walking along the path, and she sees a loaf of bread. And then all of a sudden, the loaf of bread, the spreads wings, and they all fly away. And it's bread and butter flies.
Right, yep, yep.
And that keeps happening. There's a whole scene where everything she sees is a little weird. And it's she sees something that she thinks is a normal thing. But in Wonderland, as she states at the beginning, Alice sets the rules for Wonderland. She says, nothing will be what it is, and everything will be what it isn't.
Right.
And so she's constantly having her expectations frustrated, because that's the nature of the land she's created for herself. I think that's what we need in the wake of modernism, is we need to have our expectations frustrated, because there's this epidemic of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
We think we know not only everything that is, but we think we know everything that's possible. And that's a very dangerous place for anything that is not God, for anything
right.
who is not God to be, right?
Well, it's this false sense of security. You know, you think you got it all figured out, that you're safe, that there's nothing else out there to learn, and then you know, you're going to be in for a rude awakening, you know,
yeah.
And that's what these fairy stories can do. It's like you get people like, who are very closed off, right? And they fall into fairyland, and they have to be humiliated. They have to be, you know, they have to deny themselves, and they will start to, you know, open up. And that's what fairyland can do, is kind of break that stuff down, break down those barriers, the closed-mindedness, and because it kind of forces you to. Otherwise, you're going to die, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and then something like you mentioned, like the Middle Ages being this age of, you know, what we perceive as superstition. That's still, that view is still around. You know, people mostly still believe that, even though it has been proven time and time again that that's not the case. And in fact, like the superstitious stuff really started coming out in the Enlightenment, right? It was after, like, that's where the majority of the witch hunts happened. That's where the majority of all these like vampire hunts and like all that stuff, like. And it's you can call it superstition or not, but like all that exploded after the Enlightenment happened, you know. So it's like it's not like the superstition went away; it like intensified.
Right.
Right. And fairy stories are they can just address these things, you know. And if you're all you have to do is be just a little open to it, you know, and then it can be, you know, it can really get a crowbar into your preconceived notions of things. What was I saying? Oh, so like with the Middle Ages, it's kind of like shocking when you, like for me, I'm a revert to the faith. So I was like kind of learning about, you know, as I'm coming back to the church, you know, I'm learning about all of these things. Like, oh, actually the Middle Ages were not these horrible places, this horrible time period of like superstition and nonsense, you know, and the Crusades largely, you know, were not what people say they were, like these like wars of conquest and stuff. And, you know, so it kind of turns your world upside down when you think that everything you thought you knew is wrong, or most of it, you know, and then it like, it's very jarring. You know, I remember feeling very, very upset, you know, and even though like what I was learning wasn't bad, it was like, it was the correct way to view things, but it was like someone was taking me and spinning me around, you know, and to get the right view, but it can be nauseating. And I think that's what, that's what fairy stories do. And it's like, it's, as I'm saying this, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's what fairy stories do. It's like they can take this, your preconceived notion, and they flip it on its head so you can see correctly.
That's right. That's right. And because we get so used to whatever we've always known.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the ideas I use in the book is an idea that it's like we're walking around in our heads. You know, Augustine has this statement that sinful man is curvatus in se, bent in upon himself. It's like you're completely bent over double and your head is facing your butt.
Yeah, right.
That's not a good way to experience the world. And, you know, what the work of Christ is rectifying, it's straightening that back up. That's
Which
what sanctification
can be painful.
Yeah, exactly. Restoring that upright orientation. But so a similar idea, what if we all think we're walking normally, but we're actually doing handstands and we're walking on our hands.
Right.
And we're upside down. And then something, you know, a saint comes along and they're upside down. And we're like, why are you upside down? And mm-hmm. the saint's like, I'm not upside down, you're upside down. And we're like, no, look, everybody else looks like me. You're the one who's upside down.
Right.
But you're walking on your hands. That's not what hands are for.
Right.
And so you come into the presence of a St. Francis or a Dominic, and it feels like your world gets flipped upside down.
Right.
But it's actually getting flipped right side up.
Right. And like, it can be very painful and disorienting and upsetting. You know, it can be very upsetting to be, because I remember one of my friends, a couple of them, she was coming into the church, and like the first time she actually heard stuff about like the Protestant Reformation and how actually, you know, it wasn't all great. In fact, like it's just, a lot of it was bad. And she was crying by the end because she didn't know that. You know, she was, it was very upsetting. You know, she eventually, you know, she's had some struggles since then, and we're not sure of her status in the church right now. It's kind of sad. But in that moment, her eyes were being opened, and she was like, oh crap, like this is hard to stomach, you know. It's like when you hear that, the truth can sound like poison, you know. It can be very bitter to swallow, like in the Goblin Market, you know, at the end when Laura is getting the pulp of fruit off of her sister's face, you know, and it's like bitter fire, you know, purging her of her sins, basically. And it can be a very painful experience, but very, very necessary for your salvation. You know, so it's like you perceive it as dangerous and maybe even toxic, but really it's the cure, and the cure is not always fun. You know,
that's what Paul describes the enemy of our work as of the apostolic work is not sinners, it's ideas that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. And so our weapons have to be divinely powerful for the tearing down of strongholds, because the enemy will build up all of these fortresses in our minds to make the truth sound like a lie,
to make
good news seem like bad news. And I think that's, I mean, it's so visible in our society today. People should be saying, if we're right, the gospel is a good spell, good news, Evangelium, then everyone should want it, right? And there have been times in human history when people have doubted the faith, but they would say things like, I wish it were true.
Yeah.
People don't really say that anymore.
Right.
People don't really wish the Christian faith is true anymore, non-Christians. They hope that it's not, because to them, the good news sounds like bad news.
Right.
Part of that has got to be down to our proclamation, but a larger part of it is down to the work that's been done culturally to turn the world upside down, to build up these strongholds so they can't see it right. In C.S. Lewis's Ransom Trilogy, there's a point where Lewis, the character, this is in Perelandra, at the beginning of Perelandra, he's going to visit Ransom, and he gets there and Ransom's out. And one of the Eldula, which are the cosmic beings that ultimately turned, or something like angels, comes into the room, and when Lewis sees it, it feels like he's not perpendicular to the floor. Like the angel isn't perpendicular to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it was turned off. It's rather that it had reference to some other standard of up and down than the local one. And when it came with his presence, it brought that with it. And so Lewis felt himself kind of tilting and uncertain where he was facing in relation to this thing. It's such a powerful image. That the real measure is not the way things look on a world where you've got to be sitting on the side of a ball, but the way they would look from heaven where there is no up and down, or where up and down is measured in terms of relation to God rather than in terms of orientation to a planetary center.
Right.
That's the kind of work we need to have done with this. Like, that's the truth of sinful humanity, even on this side of sacramental regeneration, because we're caught in between our sacramental regeneration and our rebirth at the resurrection on the second day. And until that day, we have this dual allegiance, right? That's what Augustine's on about, the city of God. We are still citizens of the city of man, even while we're now citizens of the city of God. And so this is what I think is so cool about fairy stories, because in a very powerful way that sidesteps a lot of the apologetics arguments of atheists versus apologists and whatnot, you can just have this story that comes and just says, like a great what if, right? What if everything you thought were the case weren't?
Right.
What you thought were most important were least important, and vice versa. Let's just follow that for a while. And because it's a supposal, because it's a what if, we'll take the journey.
Right.
And just going on the – everyone who loves story knows this. Just going on the journey of a story, whether you believe it's true or not, changes you.
Right.
You see things, you experience things, you come away different than before. Everyone's willing, not everyone, but so many of us are willing to take the fairy journey, even if we're not willing to reconsider the things that fairy journey will ask us to reconsider.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we might find ourselves reconsidering some things we weren't willing to reconsider.
Right. Well, I think in the Space Trilogy, there's a note at the end, I think it was out of the Silent Planet, that C.S. Lewis said, in the voice of Ransom, if there's one thing he wanted readers to get out of this, because he goes on this journey, comes back, and then he's like, well, no one's going to believe me about my story, so I have to turn it into a fiction, you know, and then fictionalize it, and then put it out that way, and then that people will read it, which is a very interesting convention. But he said that... if there's one thing I want readers to take away is the substituting the concept of space, like the modern concept of empty, void, dead space, with the concept of the heavens, you know, there's life out there. It's life abundantly, you know, and the light is regenerating, you know, light from the sun, unfiltered by the atmosphere of Earth, which is the silent planet, you know, which is the fallen planet. And so you get like the cosmic sort of like life energy, like undiluted, you know, and like all of these Eldillas, you know, Eldils, all these angelic beings live out there in the, you know, in the cosmos, in the heavens. And he's like, if that's one thing, I wanted people to shift their view a little bit. And I think that's what these stories can do, is like they can just shift you a little. All you have to do is kind of like push you a little bit. And then it could be enough of an opening, you know, for you to be open to talking about things. Like for me, it was the Screwtape Letters. I was in college and I've talked about this before on the show, but I was not a practicing Catholic. You know, my girlfriend, soon to be eventually wife, actually we were just friends at that point, but she was Catholic and her friend was Catholic and they were reading the Screwtape Letters. And I'm like, oh, it sounds interesting. Like two demons talking to each other. It sounds interesting. So I read it and it really did change my view of things. You know, it really did shift things, mentally, you know, and it made me open to at least having conversations about that stuff. And so it really can affect people. But it does it in a way that's not like in your face, you know. It's very much just like, this is just a story, just hear me out, you know, like
it's just for fun,
you know, don't worry about it, you know. It's it's kind of like what I do with my kids when I'm trying to teach them things, you know. It's like, it's just fun, it's just a fun thing we're gonna do, and if you learn something along the way, then that's great.
Right. Mary Poppins, like, let's play games, come, well, we get this half done, or let's clean up the nursery.
Right, yeah exactly.
And the newest refers to this is, and I've always loved this way of thinking about things, that what fiction can do is steal past watchful dragons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? I'm on the lookout for anyone trying to convince me. I don't want to be taken in. Well, can I tell you a story? Oh yeah, I love stories.
Right, yeah, stories are good. Yeah. So yeah, it's the, with the different virtues of these stories, they can be kind of a tonic for these modern illnesses. The one that I'm really interested in is the concept of mischief. So you go into the concept of mischief to a good extent in here. So what is mischief?
Yeah, mischief. A really great starting place for thinking about mischief is to think about the Norse god Loki. Mm-hmm. That's what he's the god of. He's the god of mischief, right? Because no, when we think of mischief, we think about practical jokes and pranks, this kind of stuff. Maybe a little, you know, elfin grin, a puck from Midsummer Night's Dream. That's our sense of mischief.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing about Midsummer Night's Dream, everything Puck does at the end of the play, if we shadows have offended, think with this and all is mended, that you have a dream in here. It's so easy to undo all the negative things that did during the course of the play. Bottom gets the ass's head taken off and we're good to go. Loki, in his mischief, Balder, who was the eldest son of Odin, was invulnerable and couldn't be killed. And so they used to play a game, which was pin the spear on the Balder. And so Balder would stand there and they would all throw weapons at him and they would bounce off of Balder and they'd all laugh and it was good fun, because Asgardians are weird. And Loki, I forget how he did it, but Loki somehow enchants this weapon such that it can kill Balder, mm-hmm. right through his vulnerable skin. And he doesn't tell anybody and he gives us a Thor. It's like, here, throw this one at him. And Thor's like, ha ha ha, of course. And he throws it and kills Balder. And mm-hmm. everyone is horrified. Right, except for Loki. Freya, their mother, is so heartbroken. She goes down to death and says, you've got to let Baldur go. You've got to let him come back alive. And she's so heartbroken that she moves death. And death says, if everything in the whole world will weep for Baldur, Baldur can come back to life. Hmm. So Freya spends the next, I don't know, for however long, going around trying to get everything to weep for Baldur. And everything does, mm-hmm. except Loki.
Mm-hmm.
Loki won't, and so Baldur has to remain dead.
Hmm.
Loki has a giantess that is his consort, and they give birth to Fenrir, the wolf that will devour the moon and kill Freya at the end. They give birth to Jormungandr, who would do battle with Thor in Ragnarok and kill Thor. All the monsters that will destroy the world at the end of Ragnarok are Loki's children.
Yeah.
They're the children of mischief.
You see?
And so mischief is, thinking about mischief then is kind of like this principle, which is neither good nor bad. It's just in service of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
What mischief points out is it's pointing to that part of the universe that won't submit to our equations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a very long time, physicists were after the unified theory, the master equation that would explain all states of matter, everything in the universe, and that sort of thing. And for a very, very long time, it was believed in the field of physics that this would be found.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've largely moved away from that. Not entirely, but largely moved away from that. And the reason is stuff just keeps not fitting.
Right.
It's the reality. You can look at this in grand scale. You say, well, I mean, technically, our whole theory about black holes and dark matter and how all that stuff works doesn't actually work. And
right.
It's just the best explanation we have so far, but they know it doesn't work.
Right.
But even on a small scale, you can look at things like in music, the circle of fifths. You start on a C, and then you play a C scale, and you go to a G, which is a fifth up. You play a G scale, and you go to a D, which is a fifth up. If you keep doing that, if you play that on, say, a string instrument, and you play it in tune every time, when you come back around to C, it will be out of tune.
Okay.
The scale of fifths, which is the basis of Western harmonics, doesn't actually arrive at the place where it started. It's broken. It doesn't work quite right.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
And there's this, you see this principle of mischief running through everything that keeps us from closing the circle on all of our things. And so I talk about this as a remedy against the modernist dogma of physicalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the reason we can't close the physical circle is because the physical is not all there is.
Right.
And so the mischievousness of fairy stories, fairies are always disrupting societies. They come in and they replace your baby with a fairy that pretends to be your baby.
Right.
Or worse, they replace it with a fetch, which is not a living creature. It's a thing. It looks like a living creature, but will ultimately explode horribly, either literally or figuratively, leaving you with nothing and possibly wrecking your house in the process. They'll come into your barn and steal the milk from your cows.
Right.
Or they don't need the milk, right? They don't care. They just do it because it's funny. Or they come into your barn and they will dry up your cow's milk so they can't give milk anymore.
Right.
Or they like your cow dead or curdle the milk in the cow's udder.
Which can be life-threatening for the people who own the cow. You know, it's exactly. A very serious thing.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not just like, it was nice when we had milk. No, this is our family won't survive or something.
We're going to die. Yeah.
So you take an iron horseshoe and you hang it up over the barn to keep fairies out. That's why there's horseshoes over things. It's to keep fairies out.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
And all of, because the town recognizes that fairy mischief, what's just funny to them, could kill us.
Right, right.
But this notion of mischief is a really nice one to show that, you know, on the one hand, I like the whimsy part of it, the idea that the world is just a sillier place than we think it is. And that's one reason why we can't fit it into our equations.
Right, it's right.
Camelot, it's a silly place.
that's right.
But also, there are malevolent beings out there fiddling with the world, making it not work out quite right. Demonic powers are real and they're doing things. And the two halves of the fairy realm, the Seelie court, the blessed court, and the unseelie court, the cursed court, gather this notion together really well. So it's not so much that I want us to long for mischief or anything like that. It's more that the idea of mischief is a really helpful way of reminding ourselves that the world is not the type of tightly closed system that we've been trying to construe it as for the last several centuries.
Right, right. Well, then there's like quantum mechanics and like entropy and, you know, and all these things that, like, with quantum mechanics, the role of attention that goes into altering how the particles move. We want to have this like closed system where we can observe it without being part of it, right? We can have all these rules, physical laws that are self-enclosed, but the problem is we're also part of that same world, you know.
That's
so
right.
It's like we also need to be factored in, and that's where a lot of the, I mean, we are the cause of our own mischief a lot of the time, you know. So that's the human sinfulness and stuff gets in the way of that too. So like with the whimsy stuff, it reminds me, going back to Susanna Clarke's book, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, when the gentleman with the thistle down hair, he gets the name for Stephen Black, you know, his quote unquote true name. And he's relating all the things that he had to do to get it, right? So like when he came over on a slave ship, His mother whispered the name. Nobody else heard it, but it was like her tears were in the floor. I can't remember what it was, but her tears were like in the planks of the ship, and then the ship was made into a house. So he had to burn the house down, killing everybody inside to get the planks of wood, the ashes, and then like the slave master, who, you know, was like abusive. He, all the girls he kissed, he has to go suck the kisses out of them, you know, and killing them in the process. All these ridiculous things he has to do, but it's also horrifying. You know, it's like these seemingly random things where he leaves a trail of bodies behind him in order to get this, to get the name, right? Which ultimately Stephen Black rejects. Because my favorite part in the show, have you seen the show, the BBC adaptation? It's very good. My favorite part, they do a really good job of making the gentleman with the thistle down here very menacing. Because in the book, he's more whimsical than menacing, but he is menacing at times. In the book, in the show, he's very, very menacing. And Stephen Black says, "Well, my christened name is Stephen," and the gentleman growls. He's like, "Oh, christened," you know, like he's setting himself up against Christianity. You know, it's very, very interesting. It's a good show. I recommend it. But so like that character embodies, I think, this mischievous sort of like Loki. You know, Loki also, like you mentioned, also embodies this mischievous quality that we don't take into account in our systems. You know, and so entropy and all of these and human sin, like it gets in the way. And besides that, our models are always going to fall short because of our own perceptions. You know, we're limited by the fact that we're humans, and we're not God. We can't see the whole picture, and we're never going to be.
We're not even angels. You know,
I mean, right? So. Yeah, yeah. We're just people, and we're pretty smart. Yeah, but
it's like Aslan says to Caspian when Caspian's disappointed to find out that he comes from pirates, and Aslan says, "You're a son of Adam."
Right.
That should be enough to lower the head of the mightiest emperor and raise the head of the lowest beggar. Right.
Right.
We are what we are, and there's joy in that. There's peace in that if we make peace with it, if we allow that to be the case.
Right.
Bacarda in Paradiso and Dante. And Dante's, she's in the lowest circle of heaven, and Dante's like, "Okay, so I get that you're like blessed. That's cool, but I mean, it would be better to be higher up, right? Just objectively speaking, higher right. up in heaven." It's just, what sounds like a really, really, you know, important question is you hear her response, and her response is just, "In His will is our peace."
Mm-hmm.
Like, it could not be better for me to be anywhere other than where God wants me to be. Even
right.
if that were a higher place in heaven, it would be worse because it's not where God wants me to be.
Right.
My peace is not related to some objective standard of how high or low I am. My peace is related to God's will.
Right. Yep, I am where He wants me to be, and that's enough. You know, it's more than enough. It should make us content. You know, at least in the next life, it's like Saint Teresa of Lisieux. You know, like talking about, you know, she is a little flower. You know, in God's meadow, if He even like deigns to look down on this tiny little violet that she is, you know, that's God made everyone. You know, He has this diversity of wildflowers. You know, and it all contributes to making the meadow beautiful. I'm completely butchering what she said, but I think I got the gist of it. So I like to butcher famous people's, you know, nice. Like Chesterton, and he's really fun to get wrong, but. So
he kind of deserves it. I feel like he would think it's hilarious.
Yes, yeah, I think he'd think it'd be funny. He's deliberately obtuse sometimes.
Yes.
Because it's entertaining to him. So what's the main takeaway you want? So the book first, where can you find the book? Because we're kind of running up against time here. And the book is On Teaching Fairy Stories, A Guide to Cultivating Wonder in Students Through Great Literature. Where can you find the book? And what's the main takeaway you want people to come away with this?
Yeah. So the book's available in Kindle and paperback formats from Amazon. And it's not terribly expensive either, which is nice.
No, it's very affordable.
And the big takeaway is this. There are more things in heaven and earth than I dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio.
Mm-hmm.
As Hamlet says. And because that's true, let's make sure that we teach our children and feed ourselves on stories in such a way that we're constantly reminded that the world is more and constantly asked to engage with the world as more, right? Preserving souls that are expansive, that have space for our neighbor, that have space for our God, that have space for a vision of ourselves that goes beyond what we dare to dream for ourselves, because our dreams for ourselves are too small.
Mm-hmm.
A soul that's got that kind of space in it cannot exist without being nurtured. The space has to constantly be nurtured. We have to keep doing things to fill the space out, otherwise it tends to shrink in on itself. And so let's think about what we're reading, what types of stories we're doing, and make sure that whatever else may be there, there are stories there that will constantly make us remember how small we are, how big the world is, and then correspondingly, how great God must be, given how much greater than the world God is.
Excellent. And this book, I mean, there's a lot in here we didn't talk about today. I mean, you have a whole, you know, sections on how to incorporate this into a classroom, like assignments, and like you give recommendations on books to include in a curriculum. And then the last three sections, I think, make the book worth it by themselves. You have a couple examples of, you know, different works, and you break them down. You kind of like you discuss them and like how to discuss these with a class. So one of them is Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti, which is a fantastic poem. And then the second one is The Hobbit. So I think those two by themselves like make the book worth it, because it really helps to kind of break those books down into the themes, and then like to help students talk about them. And then the last section, the postscript. What do you mean by, the postscript, The Nature of Fairyland. I was about to read one of my questions that we don't have time for. So what does Fairyland offer, and what does Fairyland require? And so that last section is fantastic. So it's kind of helpful not to talk about everything, because it makes, you know, it gives people reason to buy the book. So it's really good. You actually were recommended to me. One of my friends, Aaron, another Aaron, a girl Aaron, she was like, hey, have you ever heard of Junius Johnson? I'm like, I think he maybe messaged me on Twitter a while ago. And and she's like, he's a new book out. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll check it out. I'm like, yeah, it is that guy. Okay, so that was kind of funny. She's like, yeah, he does all these things on fairy stories and stuff. And I'm like, oh, awesome. So that's how I, you know, people recommend other guests to me. I find them, you know, I find their books or whatever, you know. And it's a lot of fun to talk to people. So I have one more question for you. And if you have listened to this show before, you know what's coming. If not, then it'll be fun either way. So this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies, because I like to say I'm personally agnostic about the existence of fairy creatures as creatures. Do you, Dr. Junius Johnson, do you believe in fairies?
Belief is said in many ways. We can get all Thomas Aquinas on you.
Right, yeah. What do you mean by belief?
It must be made this way. Now, if you're asking, do I believe that it's possible that in walking through certain parts of England, Ireland, or Scotland, or wherever, one might come across an actual creature from such as described in fairy lore, then the answer would be no.
Okay.
But. if the question is, do I believe that something as wild and wonderful as what we describe in fairy stories, and more so, exists in the world we actually inhabit? Then the answer is a resounding yes. I doubt the fairies are real as such, because that's the way those are stories we've told to try to make sense of the world to ourselves. Mm-hmm. They're no more likely to be real than the Greek gods are likely to be real. But the reason we keep having Greek gods and Norse gods and fairies and all these other sorts of things is because we keep bumping up against stuff from the world that won't fit into other categories. And so we have to create categories for them. And when we see the reality of which the fairies are a shadow, we'll understand both how much the fairies were a shadow, but also how right we were to have something like fairies to try to account for that.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. They're a way of accounting for chaos. Basically,
for
the things that don't fit into our models. I like that. Great. There's always a but when people say, I don't believe in physical fairies, but, you know, like, so yeah, I get all sorts of answers.
I found you because of the title of the podcast, I Might Believe in Fairies. I was like, oh, well, see, that's interesting to me. because it's not a I believe in fairies, which makes me nervous, and it's not a I don't believe in fairies, which makes me sad. It's this is not to be dismissed simply,
right?
And somebody who thinks that and names their podcast after that, that's somebody I can talk with.
Well, you should probably talk to my wife because she's the one who actually came up with the name. So, but the name works really well. It was a really good name because, yeah, for exactly what you said, it's this kind of this openness, you know, to talking about these things that, you know, after the Enlightenment were treated as childish. And you know, and certain Christians view it as like demonic, you know, and so it's like, no, it's neither of those things. It's something else. And so, and obviously, I don't just talk about fairy stories. I mean, this is like, you know, all sorts of things I have, you know, talk about on the show. But yeah, that's partly why that name works so well. And I didn't come up with it. It was my wife. And I like to point that out to people because she gets mad when I don't. So,
well, for example, whenever I talk about dragons, I can't say that there's no such thing as a dragon in our world. Mm-hmm. Right? I simply don't know.
Right.
And so I'll say something like, if it turns out to be true that there are no dragons in our world.
Right.
We haven't explored most of the planet, and especially, you know, the depths of the ocean, but even the land masses, there are whole bits that we know next to nothing about. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, humility is an important aspect of right relationship to the world, I think.
Yeah. Yep. And that's a good relationship with fairy too. you gotta be humble. Otherwise the fairyland's going to humble you. All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I'll let you get going to your next engagement.
Thank you. This has been really fun. Let's get some time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.